talked about the operation for a few minutes. The decision was now made, so I did not feel the need to stress the risks as I had done in the outpatient clinic, although I still had to refer to them when I got her to sign the complicated consent form. "I hope you get some sleep," I said. "I promise you I will, which is more important in the circumstances." She smiled at the joke, a joke I make with all my patients when I see them the night before surgery. She probably knew already that the last thing you get in hospital is peace, rest, or quiet, especially if you are to undergo brain surgery next morning. I saw the other two patients who were also on the list for surgery and went over the details of their operations with them. They signed the consent forms, and as they did so, both of them had told me how they trusted me. Anxiety might be contagious, but confidence is also contagious, and as I walked to the hospital car park, I felt buoyed up by my patient's trust. I felt like the captain of a ship. Everything was in order, everything was shipshape, and the decks were cleared for action, ready for the operating list tomorrow. Playing with these happy nautical metaphors as I left the hospital, I went home. After the morning meeting, I went to the anaesthetic room where the patient was lying on a trolley, waiting to be anaesthetized. "Good morning," I said, attempting to sound cheerful. "Did you sleep well?" "Yes," she replied calmly. "I had a good night's sleep." "Everything's going to be fine," I said. I could only wonder once again whether she really appreciated the risks to which she was about to be exposed. Perhaps she was very brave, perhaps naive. Perhaps she had not really taken in what I had told her. In the changing room, I stripped off and climbed into theatre pyjamas. One of my consultant colleagues was getting changed as well, and I asked him what was on his list for the day. "Oh, just a few backs," he said. "You've got the aneurysm." "The trouble with unruptured aneurysms," I said, "is that if they wake up wrecked, you've only yourself to blame. They're in perfect nick before the op. At least with the ruptured ones, they're often already damaged by the first bleed." "True, but the unruptured ones are usually much easier to clip." I went into the theatre, where Jeff, my registrar, was positioning the woman on the operating table. "My department is unusual in having American surgeons from the neurosurgical training program in Seattle, who train with us for a year at a time. Jeff was one of these, and, as with most of the American trainees, he was outstanding. He was clamping her head to the table. Three pins attached to a hinged frame are driven through the scalp into the skull to hold the patient's head immobile. I had promised her a minimal head shave, and Jeff started to shave the hair from her forehead. There is no evidence that the complete head shaves we did in the past, which made the patients look like convicts, had any effect on infection rates, which had been the ostensible reason for doing them. I suspect the real, albeit unconscious, reason was that dehumanizing the patients made it easier for the surgeons to operate. With the minimal headshave completed, we go to the scrub-up sink and wash our hands, and then, gloved and masked and gowned, return to the table and start the operation. The first 10 minutes or so are spent painting the patient's head with antiseptic, covering her with sterile towels so that I can only see the area to be operated upon, and setting up the surgical equipment and instruments with the scrub nurse. "Knife," I say to Erwin, the scrub nurse. "I'm starting," I shout to the anaesthetist at the other end of the table, and off we go. After 30 minutes of working with drills and cutters powered by compressed air, the woman's skull is open and the uneven ridges of bone on the inside of her skull have been smoothed down with a cutting burr. "Lights away, microscope in, and the operating chair," I shout, as much from excitement as from the need to make myself heard above the rattle and hum and hissing of all the equipment and machinery in the theatre. Modern binocular operating microscopes are wonderful things, and I am deeply in love with the one I use, just as any good craftsman is with his tools. It cost over £100,000, and although it weighs a quarter of a ton, it is perfectly counterbalanced. Once in place, it leans over the patient's head like an inquisitive, thoughtful crane. The binocular head, through which I look down into the patient's brain, floats as light as a feather on its counterbalanced arm in front of me, and the merest flick of my finger on the controls will move it. Not only does it magnify, but it illuminates as well, with a brilliant xenon light source, as bright as sunlight. Two of the theatre nurses, bent over with the effort, slowly push the heavy microscope up to the table, and I climb into the operating chair behind it, a specially adjustable chair with armrests. This moment still fills me with awe. I have not yet lost the naive enthusiasm with which I watched that first aneurysm operation 30 years ago. I feel like a medieval knight mounting his horse and setting off in pursuit of a mythical beast. And the view down the microscope into the patient's brain is indeed a little magical. Clearer, sharper, and more brilliant than the world outside, the world of dull hospital corridors and committees and management and paperwork and protocols. There is an extraordinary sense of depth and clarity produced by the microscope's hugely expensive optics, made all the more intense and mysterious by my anxiety. It is a very private view, and although the surgical team is around me, watching me operate on a video monitor connected to the microscope, and although my assistant is beside me looking down a sidearm, and despite all the posters in the hospital corridors about something called clinical governance proclaiming the importance of teamwork and communication, for me this is still single combat. "Well, Jeff, let's get on with it, and let's have a brain retractor," I add to Erwin. I choose one of the retractors, a thin strip of flexible steel with a rounded end like an ice cream stick, and place it under the frontal lobe of the woman's brain. I start to pull the brain upwards away from the floor of the skull. Elevation is the proper surgical word. Cautious millimetre by cautious millimetre, creating a narrow space beneath the brain along which I now crawl towards the aneurysm. After so many years of operating with the microscope, it has become an extension of my own body. When I use it, it feels as though I am actually climbing down the microscope into the patient's head, and the tips of my microscopic instruments feel like the tips of my own fingers. I point out the carotid artery to Jeff and ask Erwin for the microscopic scissors. I carefully cut the gossamer veil of the arachnoid around the great artery that keeps half the brain alive. "What a fantastic view," says Jeff. And it is, because we are operating on an aneurysm before a catastrophic rupture, and the cerebral anatomy is clean and perfect. "Let's have another retractor," I say. Armed now with two retractors, I start to prise apart the frontal and temporal lobes. They're held together by a fine layer of the meninges, which is called the arachnoid, after the Greek word for a spider, as it looks as though it was made from the strands of the finest spider's web. Cerebrospinal fluid, known to doctors as CSF, as clear as liquid crystal, circulating through the strands of the arachnoid, flashes and glistens like silver in the microscope's light. Through this, I can see the smooth yellow surface of the brain itself, etched with minute red blood vessels, arterioles, which form beautiful branches like a river's tributaries seen from space. Glistening dark purple veins run between the two lobes, leading down towards the middle cerebral artery and ultimately to where I will find the aneurysm. Awesome!